Early in the morning, rising to the street. Light me up that cigarette, and I strap shoes on my feet. Got to find a reason, reason things went wrong. Got to find a reason why my money's all gone. I got a Dalmatian, I can still get high. I can play the guitar like on.
Hey everybody, welcome to Drive Through HR, Brian, William, and Nisha. Coming to you every single day, talking to the people, with the people who love HR. Today is no exception to that rule. So let's get to our guest because I think he's got some things to share. He might change some lives today. So no pressure. None. So Ted Coignier, how's that?
Yeah.
Damn, yeah, I'm balling now. So welcome to the show, and I hope you're having a great day.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, I absolutely am. I'm in Naples, Florida. We're having a cold spell, which means that it's it went under 70 for the first time this year, and it's sunny. So come on down, folks, if it's getting cold where you are. So you can't have a bad day when that happens.
That is a true statement right there. So, well, if you could introduce, let's kick it off. And you're now that you've ruined like the rest of the day for everybody that lives north of about Pittsburgh, Kansas, and it's cold as hell up here. Then it's all right. You know, you just upped your game a little bit. So introduce yourself to our lovely listeners, and we'll roll from there.
Okay, good. Besides being a weather bully, I have to apologize, folks. I am the co-CEO of switchandshift.com, which is a website dedicated to promoting the human side of business. So HR is right in our sweet spot. You are the folks that we love and work with every day. I'm a multiple author. The next book I'm working on is called A World Gone Social, How Companies Must Adapt to Survive. And I've been ranked by Forbes for my social media influence, which I think is kind of funny because it's sort of like being an expert in email. I do social media. I don't think about it too much. So that's me in a nutshell.
Nice. Take us into switching shift. How did you first started? I know that you founded it with some folks. So tell us the story of kind of how it came to be. And what do you all do? Because I think a lot of people on the outside look at it and consume the content, but there's obviously more context than that.
Sure. Okay, thanks. Thanks, Liam. So Switch and Shift started. It's a funny story that I love to tell because so my friend who I met on Twitter, Sean Murphy, was producing content that I really respected. Who knows? You know, we found each other through mutual interest in business leadership or something like that. So at one point a few years ago, he invited me to guest post on his blog at the time. And I had my own blog, and we each probably had a few hundred people reading it. So it was such a positive experience for me, and I guess for him too, that I said to myself, you know, I like what Sean stands for, and I know that the two of us together to be, you know, 1 + 1 = 4 rather than just 3. Let's see if he's interested in putting a blog together with me. So I reached out to him, and it took 8 months for him to say, yeah, you know, all right, let's do it. 8 months. So the nice thing is we have about 50,000 people a month and growing fast who find Switch and Shift and stick around and bring their friends. There's a real need out there for business to be more human-centric than it is today in a lot of companies. And leaders get that. So we have a lot of leaders who use Switch and Shift, and also folks who hope to lead in the future are tuned into that as well.
And how do you make money?
Okay, so we have started. We have a very strict red velvet rope policy, but we've started with a couple of sponsors. So they have to be companies that we believe in. But you'll see right now we have Root. It's on Twitter. It's the Root Learning, and we also have Sprinklr, And those are two companies that we already had relationships with, so we reached out to them and said, hey, you know, we like what you believe in, and would you like to be sponsors of Switch and Shift? And then, so that's how Switch and Shift has become my full-time job. Sean is a consultant. I consult with businesses. I consult on modern corporate strategy as opposed to dated corporate strategy. And also, I love giving keynotes. So if there's anybody looking for a speaker, I'd be very happy to talk with you about that.
Awesome. Well, let me ask you on the consulting side, because you interact with boards, you interact with the C-suite. Give the audience a taste of what's their perception, those that don't have a dual role in maybe HR and also on the board or CHROs, they might have some of that insight. But what's the board's perception of HR?
Well, see, you know, that's really funny. I think the fact that most companies do not have C in front of the letters HR, that's a terrible mistake. And it shows disrespect. I was just thinking about how many C-level executives there are these days. Every company has, of course, a CEO, but a CFO, CIO, CMO, CSO could stand for either strategy or security. I've seen both, and sometimes they have both together in the same company. And then HR is usually a vice president, not always, but often. And that's just wrong-headed. As Jack Welch pointed out in Winning, which he wrote years ago, and, you know, he's an industrial age leader. You wouldn't imagine he was the most modern leader for, you know, 2013 when we're talking. But he said, when I visit divisions and talk to the executives in charge, the most important one I talk to is not the CFO, and it's not the COO of the division or business unit. It's the head of HR. If he said that way back in the 20th century, well, you know what? The clock has moved along. So anyway, there's this whole disparity from one board to another as far as how important they understand that HR is.
And Ted, do you think importance is size of budget or some type of financial commitment to people, human talent, or do you think it's a commitment to the senior leadership role? A lot of the times that's a CHRO position or the highest level HR position. Like, what do you think shows to you their commitment, the action behind their words? Is it just pure budget or is it just the right people in charge? What is it?
Well, sometimes, you know, you're going to have a budget that has an awful lot of money dedicated to marketing. I mean, that's just kind of normal. And I read research a couple of years ago that said that the CMO is getting more money than the CIO, for instance. Now, HR does not necessarily need a budget on that scale, or, you know, if you're a manufacturer, never mind. But the size of budget isn't really what's most important. It's who's getting invited to the table and where do they sit. So if you think of the old-fashioned round table, who sits to the right of King Arthur? If King Arthur is the CEO of the company, who is the person to the right that's a symbolic, and I'm using this symbolically, but it's the symbolic seat for the most important person. And then the second most important person sits on the left. Well, if HR isn't right there advising the CEO and going to board meetings and presenting there regularly, right there already we have a problem.
If you could wave your wand, and I just gave you a magic wand, if you could wave your wand and change anything about HR, either its practice or process or the way we think about HR, what would you change?
I'll tell you, well, the one thing that would be really easy to change, I love the term people rather than human resources. So, for instance, Southwest they have a people department, and that term has been in their company for years and years. Humans are not resources. Humans are not expendable. Humans are business. That's all we are. So that's the first thing. That's an easy one. I mean, you know, internally maybe not, but as far as, boom, there you go. I just waved my wand. But more important and less symbolically, I think, HR, sometimes people get it and sometimes they don't, depending on the company, the professional, the individual. HR should never be the enforcer of process and rules. And too often people are stuck in that position who are HR professionals, and it's unfortunate. sometimes they're put in that role. It's not of their choosing. They step into it, or they're expected to be in that role. HR is, they're the talent scouts and the culture builders. That's what I wish, you know, all HR professionals at all levels of the organization really got behind. And if you want to kick me off your show right now, I understand.
No, you're. I mean, you're still you're still trending upwards, so we're good. I sent out a bunch of follow Friday, so just to make sure that we got that whole crew too, just to get behind you.
Oh no.
So culture, you said culture. So what seems to be the big, gigantic, gaping disconnect between CEO, culture, and the HR leadership, like that all just working? Because it just seems like it's such an easy equation to look at and go, yeah, this makes sense. Happier employees, happier customer service, happier product delivery, more innovation, more inspiration. Why is that such a big deal that it just doesn't work?
You know, this really is why I have built my career. It drives me insane. So let's start with a little framing. I have a simple formula that I like to share with audiences. It goes like this. Leadership plus culture plus engagement equals profits. And if you want to get drilled down a little bit, culture of, you know, customer service works for me. I've written two books on that topic. But that simple formula, leadership, culture, engagement equals profit. Now, the thing is about leadership. Leadership sets the tone and leadership perpetuates the culture, and this is whether you're, you know, the CEO or the head of HR or anybody in a leadership role. But culture is the 99% of the action that's actually driving the business. The leadership is only the 1% that kind of gets culture going and makes sure it's still going. You have a healthy culture, engagement follows as a result of that. Now, I think most companies, the executives, let's face it, we were raised, including me, I'm 46, we were raised in the industrial age. And if you can't measure it, it doesn't count. The funny thing is the person who came up with that quote, that's exactly the opposite of what the quote is. The things that we can't measure, this is Deming, by the way, writing in the 1940s, the things we can't measure are the most important. So this whole ethic that, if you can't measure it, never mind, and the culture is squishy, that's just sad. You know what culture is? Culture is getting out of the office, no matter who you are, locking yourself out of your office, and then stick your key under the door so you can't get back in. Walk around and talk to people all day long. So no matter the role, the leader's job is to talk to people. And while talking, find out what's going on with the people whose feet are on the street, the people talking to the customer directly, and then find out what's working, what's not working, fix one and promote the other, get more of what's working going. That's how leadership is.
Ted, you've mentioned culture, and I got to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Do you think culture is singular, or do you think that companies have maybe multiple or multiplicity of cultures? And
yeah, that's a good question. Sorry, go ahead.
No, and then how do you manage it? Either way.
No, that's a really good question. So especially with larger companies, you're going to find a multiplicity of cultures. I used to canoe when I was a little kid. I still love it, but I don't live near white water anymore. But when I was a kid, I lived in New England, and I would canoe with my dad, and you have the river going all in one direction, of course, but then you have, behind rocks, you have little eddies, and down, you know, there's a little stream feeding into the river that's, you know, backwater. Well, these little, as an analogy, those are subcultures within the culture. So sure, the water eventually is going down the river towards the ocean, and that's your culture of, for instance, you know, we take really good care of our customers, and it shows, and here are some examples, boom, 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 all right? That's how a culture, a predominant culture works. Not all cultures are like that, by the way. That you could have a culture of secrecy. You could have a culture of fear. But the predominant culture of the organization, yes, is one thing. But then you look within the different eddies and backwaters, and you will find cultures that also have other themes within them. So, for instance, I wrote a blog post that was pretty popular a couple of years ago, The Law of the Umbrella. If you're a leader in middle management someplace or frontline management, and you work for an organization that is raining just, you know, misery down on your staff, your job is to be the umbrella for them, to protect them from that. So you can create, so for instance, say you're the manager of a particular location, a store, for instance, you can create a culture that deviates from the main culture within the company. You know, some of us have more latitude than others, but you can make your, that's how one store, for instance, in a retail environment will really, really knock everyone's shoes off, whereas they go to the next sucker. They go to the next store in the same chain, and they're less impressed. That's how that works. It's the local culture. And unfortunately, you can also have a local culture of people who don't, you know, give a darn. That happens a lot.
All right, I got to ask your take on leadership. So leadership, nature versus nurture, and what's your take on leadership development?
Well, leadership development is the number one training spend that there is. Let me get back to that one in a minute because I have something that's going to really make some development countries companies angry. Nature versus nurture, anything you talk about, some things come easier to you than others. One of my daughters is really good at math. One has trouble. They both get A's in math because the one who has trouble at it just keeps working until she gets it. So, yes, some of us find leadership much easier than others. But we humans are – the way our brain is wired is to learn stuff. We know literally nothing until we learn it. So can you learn leadership? Absolutely. I've never seen somebody who just – I mean, except for, you know, maybe a – somebody who's literally autistic. I've never seen somebody who can't relate to other people and can't be taught some good methods to do that better, to inspire better, to, you know, it's absolutely learnable. Now, having said that, what is the number one way I recommend that you you train your leaders to be better leaders? Get them involved in volunteer work. I was CEO of my first company, and then I went into the nonprofit realm for 2 years. That experience was priceless, and I am a much better leader because of it now that I'm in my third endeavor as CEO of a for-profit again. When you lead volunteers, boy, you can't tell them they're fired. They don't have jobs. You can't tell them that you're going to pay them a bonus because you don't pay bonuses in nonprofit work. These people are there on their own volition, and they can go to the other, you know, charity down the street if you don't make it engaging for them. That is a great way, and by the way, free, for any company to develop better leaders.
Nice. I really like that, and we'll come back to that just right after the reset. Everybody listening to Drive Through HR, Brian and William, having a great conversation with Ted Coignet, author, huge blogging and email and social media expert. Email expert, I like that. That's
no, I'm sorry. I would say I'm not – being a social media expert, it strikes me as nothing special, kind of like being an email expert.
Yeah, that's good, though. We need email experts. I'm just saying, buggy whippish as it is. All good. So, so kind of the, you know, that literally speaks to a lot of, you know, and there's been lots of books written on the volunteer and volunteerism and volunteer leadership is, I mean, that's really the lead from the heart component, right? Because that's ultimately what people are not vested there because of comp. They're not, they don't have to be there. There's some reason that they want to spend their time away from family, friends, their life, and actually contribute. And so that lead from the heart component, I think, is a really, really interesting, probably piece of information that I'm going to research actually maybe this afternoon because I'm intrigued on level of volunteerism as it relates to profit and some of the other metrics that you look at, you know, around business. So,
Well, thanks. I really appreciate that, Brian. You know, the thing is, what you find also with volunteerism is not only does it teach really good leadership skills, you know, you put somebody in charge of a project, they're going to learn how to be a leader or else they're going to fail at that project when they're running volunteer effort. But the other thing is, it makes people feel better about themselves. You give somebody a bonus and encourage them to go spend it, which, for instance, sales organizations are famous for. I cut my teeth in sales when I was in my 20s. And, you know, okay, great. Yeah, I worked really hard for that bonus. I got the bonus. My jerk boss told me to spend it instead of save it, which is another conversation for another day. But that's a fleeting type of joy. Within, you know, a month or two, people who buy an expensive car, the shine wears off, and then they're stuck with this expensive, you know, monthly payment. Well, you get somebody involved in volunteering, or, you know, better yet, you do it yourself, you just feel good helping others. It gives you kind of a lift in your step, and also when people are at work and they work for a company that encourages volunteerism a lot rather than just paying lip service to it, that company, you're going to have a better esprit de corps because people say, you know, this company isn't just lip service. This company isn't just the work we do to collect our checks. We actually stand for something.
Absolutely. Ted, I want to, before we run out of time, I want to make sure and get back to keynotes. So thank you for kind of going a little further on that, and I completely agree. But keynotes, you do some keynotes, and I want to figure out for all our audience, what do you talk about? And one, why do you feel that you are able to connect with the audience and make a difference? So two-part question.
Okay, all right. The first thing is my number one topic has become, well, engagement, because that's so vital and so few employees are engaged. Helping companies get there, they desperately need advice on that. The other thing, though, because I've got kind of a social media following, is the way that social media has transformed business. And I'm not talking about how it will, although it will transform it more and more. How it already has that a lot of companies haven't got onto yet. They're in big trouble. So I'm writing a book with Mark Babbitt of U-Turn called A World Gone Social, How Companies Must Adapt to Survive. The industrial age and the way of management that worked in the industrial age did work. Command and control, hierarchy, bureaucracy, keeping people to metrics and who cares about the heart part of it. That was really effective last century. September 17th, 2008, Lehman Brothers failed, and that's really where I would draw the line in the sand. We are in the social age now. And sometimes that has nothing to do with social media practices whatsoever. But we need the ethic of social media, which is more giving, more interaction, less broadcasting. That bringing that to businesses is something that is very popular, I guess, because like I said, I've got a social media reputation.
Ted, what's the one thing that people kind of don't get about you?
Well, the thing they do get about me for sure is that I find it very hard to not have fun at any time. So you hear me right now laughing. That's pretty much the way I go through my life. In fact, maybe they don't understand that I'm not always jolly. But let's see, what do people not understand about me? It's hard to say because, you know, I'm really my heart is on my sleeve. I don't believe in this whole, you know, this is my work self, this is my home self. Pretty much, this is me. And I may be a bit different, a heretic. I'm a business heretic. Somebody called me that a while before, and I just kind of embraced it. Yeah, I look at things that may be obvious to others, and I say, I don't get it. It doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. You're going to have to explain this. Having that outsider's view, even when you are inside of an organization, that's what any good consultant will do, and that's something that I have been able to keep with me regardless of what I'm doing in my career that, you know, at that time.
What I want to get your take on social media rules. Do you believe that there are actual rules in social media, meaning right and wrong, do this, don't that, black and white? Do you believe that there are rules via social media?
Social media is social. If I were to put this on a slide, I would have a huge word, social, all in in caps and a tiny little word media in parentheses. So that's really where almost every company still gets it wrong, is they think it's media. It has very little to do with media. So what are the rules of being social? Well, you know what? They're the same rules that we learned. I think somebody wrote a book about this years and years ago. Everything I needed to learn, I learned in kindergarten. Well, be nice. That's social. Rather than saying, hey, thanks for following me on Twitter, like my Facebook page. I mean, that's just the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life, and I get it every single day, literally. So companies that do that, that's dumb. Companies that engage with people where they are, that show that they're human first, because the person behind that Facebook page or that Twitter feed, that's a person. That's a social rule that I think is steadfast. You can't really thrive on social. I've seen many companies fail, and many individuals fail because they ignored that part of it.
So, Ted, so rules are for fools. That's what I heard out of that. I like that.
I like it. Be nice. That's pretty much the only rule in business or social media.
I am picking up what you're putting down there. So for the HR professionals out there, which that's a lot of our, the majority of our audience, how do you define risk? What's risky to you as you be in business, and you obviously, a lot of you personally is in what you do. Define risk real quick for us.
So the way that I define risk as an entrepreneur, that's just my nature from birth, really. I was raised that way, is not being ahead of the curve. If you make change happen, there's nothing scary about change whatsoever. Make change happen to your competition. That's the way to mitigate risk. I think, unfortunately, especially with the larger an organization gets, the more risk-averse people they attract. You see that often when there's a big company buys a small one, that the people at the small company say, oh, man, we've got so much process here. The fun's all gone. We need a startup mentality. We're out of here. So risk to me is being bogged down in bureaucracy and process and not being nimble. I'm going to say something very heretical right now. The annual planning cycle and annual budget cycle, I don't get it. It's 2013. You can't. It's almost 2014. You can't possibly run a company that way in the 2010s. Got to be able to turn on a dime and do it often.
So what's your recommendation? We've got about 2 minutes left, but what's your recommendation to change up the typical business cycles? Because I read that on your blog, by the way, that you always offer – an alternative solution. You don't just take a shot.
Yeah, exactly. So here's the thing. If you treat your people well and respectfully, you're going to thrive in business. Like people, you'll be good at business. That's just a rule that I carry close to my heart. And if you run your company that way and treat them, Douglas McGregor did research on this way back in the 1950s. If you trust people, they'll be trustworthy, and you'll attract more trustworthy people. A lot of companies are still stuck in that, oh, we don't trust people, we need to measure them. That's not the way to run any type of an organization. That's my number one advice. My number two advice in the last minute of this show, go to Switch and Shift, because there's a lot more talent there than what you're hearing right now. We've got phenomenal guest bloggers, and our League of Extraordinary Thinkers is second to none.
I love, well, check it out, folks. It's good stuff. Spent a bunch of time on there before the show, and who doesn't want to visit a League of Extraordinary Thinkers? That's just all the way down. So, Ted, thank you so much for coming on and joining us for lunch. Great conversation. Look forward to getting on the blog myself and digging in there, and hopefully meet you in person here in the not-too-distant future.
Awesome. Brian, William, Nisha, if you're there, thank you very much for having me on the show today.
Perfect. Folks, have a great rest of the day. We're out of here.